For one summer in 2003, glam metal was back. We may never know the exact reason why, but the Darkness would release an album in 2003 called Permission to Land that took the world by storm. But why did it get so big? Let's see if we can't find an answer to this question during the review. ...2003 was an interesting time in the music industry. It was 12 years after Nirvana's Nevermind destroyed multiple genres and changed the entire scene forever. The last bastions of glam metal's old guard had either retired, split up, or were releasing subpar records. Van Halen had made Van Halen 3, Motley Crue made New Tattoo, Wasp Unholy Terror, Def Leppard X, The Cult Beyond Good and Evil, and the last bastion to that genre, Guns N' Roses, were still in an ugly dispute that would see the band only give dialogue through lawyers. In fact, Chinese Democracy was still 7 years off from being released, so by my maths, it was 5 years in production at this stage. All of this points to a genre that was pretty much completely destroyed from the inside out, as bands' egos grew too large or others tried to assimilate to the new styles of music at the time. On the other hand, 2003 was seeing a shift in musical styles that were trending. Nu metal was pretty much on the deathbed, and in its wake, other styles were rising to the ranks, such as indie and garage rock bands. The emo rock movement was just around the corner, and so I bring you the first point, which is right place, right time. Throughout music's history, this is quite an important point to be made. Several bands and their albums that became big deals were because of this reason. I mean, if it was dropped a year later, it would probably have been lost in the tidal wave that was the emo movement. Now, I don't want to get people confused and say this is the only reason for its success, but it is a contributing factor. After all, if an album doesn't sound good, then what use is it? Luckily for us, The Darkness had this incredible album on offer, and for me, it's one of my favourite albums of 2003. And that's coming from a year full of amazing albums that were released. One of the most prominent features of a band is their frontman, the centrepiece of the band, the voice of the band, the image of the band. And The Darkness had one of the best in the industry with Justin Hawkins. To paraphrase Raymond Chandler, every man wants to be Justin Hawkins, and every woman wants to be with him. Justin Hawkins is the trifecta when it comes to frontmen, an extremely funny individual who is charismatic beyond any doubt and can also play guitar. On top of this, Justin also had an extremely defined vocal style, which is his signature mark and very unique. The charismatic voice does a fantastic video which dissects his vocal patterns and abilities. I do recommend that you check out her video detailing it after you watch this one, of course. And if you haven't done so, make sure to subscribe to this channel. Out of all the frontmen that you could name in rock and roll history, there is always someone else to help them in the songwriting. Mick Jagger has Keith Richards, Robert Plant had John Paul Jones, and John Lennon had Paul McCartney. When it comes to The Darkness, you have Dan Hawkins, Frankie Pullen, and Ed Graham. Dan Hawkins is the brother of Justin and performs alternating lead and rhythm guitar duties with Justin. Frankie was the bass guitarist for the band, performing plucky and punchy rhythmic sections to their songs. Finally, Ed Graham was the drummer for the group, and it was this powerhouse trio that helped them formulate a tight rhythm section within the band. And this pretty much rounds out the group for the time during its 2003 release. Originally, these four musicians started off as a covers band. In fact, they were barely noticed by any record companies, with only two prospects showing interest. They eventually signed to Atlantic Records to record their debut album. Being young and adventurous, the band was full of ideas, and they would put pen to paper to record them. When you are releasing a debut album, you need to have a very strong opener. Usually, this would be the song that gets people's attention when they first heard it, as it would be played on the CDs in the record stores back in the day, when that was still a thing at least. It may also be the very first song that people were streaming when looking up music at certain websites, as they had this little 30-second soundbite to hear, and if you liked it, you would probably buy the CD. Black Shuck is an exemplary opening track. An insanely loud opening riff hooks you in and keeps you focused on what is playing out. The song itself tells the tale of a curious beast that is a local myth to the area near where this was recorded and written. A giant dog that is somewhat of a cryptoid that strikes fear in people and driven home with that repeated line of the title track. Eventually, this dog comes to hound the entire city and they prepare their defenses for the attack. For a song with a dark story, it's written in a way that kind of lightens the mood. In particular, the ending line in the verse that goes, "This track really starts off on the right foot." If we are going to talk about this album, then we really need to discuss the singles. And there were 5 released from an album with 10 tracks, not including the bonus editions. The first single was "Get Your Hands Off My Woman." A story about a drunk individual with enough hands as an octopus who is in a Latino lover mode, and as the song suggests, they can't keep their hands off Justin's woman. It's capped off with a fast-paced guitar chops that come out and assault you like the person in this story. It's a good song. In fact, it's really good. But it didn't really catch the public's attention at the time, even becoming, in hindsight, their lowest selling single. And this song was chosen to showcase the band. While fans would enjoy the song, it perhaps wasn't putting their best foot forward. The next single was "Growing On Me," a song that is a nonsense rock and roll track with big, meaty hooks and solid bass lines, assisted by that 4-4 drum beat. A real classic rocker tune with lyrics about a one-sided love affair and diminishing results over time. Or have we been deceived all this time? Many have speculated the song is in fact about STIs, in particular pubic lice, as the lyrics could allude to this. I can't get rid of you. It's perhaps not helped that the cover photo that was chosen for this single is a close-up of Justin's crutch, knee shirt and an open zipper. Nice tattoo. Hawkins has addressed this rumour with a cheeky retort, stating that it's wrong, as pubic lice don't grow on you, do they? Oh, but how do you know, Justin? How do you know? Is this still a review on The Darkness, or have I started a review on a Steel Panther album? I'm confused. Well, I suppose it could be open to interpretation, as the song is somewhat vague, and it could be a rather British thing to do for the band. That is, to write a song about love, and draw open parallels to getting pubic lice in the process. I never thought I'd cover this subject on my channel. Let's move on. Okay, so let's talk about the song that broke them into the mainstream, the third single from the album, and first released after the record was dropped. Yep, time to talk about "I Believe in a Thing Called Love." This is easily their most recognisable song, and all the pieces just fall together here. This has one of the greatest opening riffs in the last 20 years that opens up to that big sound that would play out in arenas shortly. But what really hammers at home is Justin's singing. Any rock star can write a classic dreamy love story about kissing you every minute, every hour, every day. But can they do it while shifting 3,000 octaves into falsetto mode? No. Not many have the balls to attempt it, let alone pull it off. Speaking of balls, I used to record skits with my friends and had an idea about this song, where it was going to be a short clip where someone was singing this tune and then they would get kicked in the balls when it gets to the high section. I know. Genius, right? If it had been in the day and age of TikTok, I could have at least got 100 views for making that video. Instead, here I am talking about this instant karaoke classic, and that's what makes it such a perfectly memorable tune. An easy to remember verse that people want to sing after knocking back a few pints in a pub on a Friday night. If your verses can be remembered by people who have smashed about 6 pints and then want to do a karaoke version of your track, then that's great. That'll add to the lastability of this song. I know people who have gone and done the karaoke versions to this and done air kicks while the guitars just do their solos. It's epic. It's over the top in parts, and that's before I talk about the video clip for this track, which looks like it was filmed on a B-grade porno set and is such a piss take that it's easily worth more than a mention. I mean, the video clip is as memorable as the song itself. This song drives a simple urge to rock out to this tune. I dare you to play it and not sing to those high notes. I believe in a thing called love. I know what you were gonna say.
Nailed them both.
This song really feels like the personification of the band. So the next single from the album was Love Is Only a Feeling, and I guess you could describe it as the power ballad. It's a slow song that opens with giant guitars before giving way to the acoustic sections, but is rather grandiose as it builds up its vocals only to give way to the guitar duties later on. This tune is a powerhouse in itself, and while it may not get the love of I Believe in a Thing Called Love, it's one of my favourite tracks from the album. I mean, as far as power ballads goes, this is one of the better ones you will hear. Also, I have to give a shout out for the band for filming this tune in Australia. In fact, it was filmed here at this very location. This is Lincoln's Rock, located near Wentworth Falls in the Blue Mountains, Sydney, Australia. The entire film clip is large in scale, just as the song is, and it uses these immaculate aerial shots by helicopters flying overhead as the band perform their song at the very cliff edge you were looking at. Justin talks about this on his podcast in an episode called Filming Love Is Only a Feeling Was Actually Very Dangerous.
What I love about that video is that there's a lot of sort of aerial shots, and there's stuff with me playing guitar solos on the side of a mountain, and I had one clip harness thing, and it was very, very dangerous. But the whole thing was filmed with helicopters. I mean, nowadays you look at any music video, you see anything aerial or even in a movie, and you just know that it's some dickhead with a drone.
I'm a little bit surprised that the video clip wasn't used by the Australian government to advertise tourism in Australia. I mean, it sums up Australia perfectly. A bunch of palms staring at our amazing views that are on offer. I mean, that film clip would shit on the other advertisement that we used.
So where the bloody hell are you?
But I guess it's not as catchy as the Northern Territory slogan. This would be the last single the band would release from the album. Now, many of you would have noticed if you were counting that I only covered 4 singles, and that's because the other one was a tune called Christmas Time that I was not privy to due to it being a bonus track on the European edition of the album. It would reappear on their future album Hotcakes, and again on their live album Streaming of a White Christmas, for whatever reason. And while I don't want to talk about Christmas songs because I feel like they're all tacky, I gotta say that I never have heard of it until I researched this episode. And it's actually not a bad track. Certainly much more bearable than Mariah Carey, and one that I would be happy to hear on repeat during the Christmas period. That's if the loop was only 2 weeks long. As far as the album goes, it's a mostly solid record with a runtime of less than 40 minutes on the standard edition. It's a perfect runtime, really. The first half of the record is definitely the strongest side that carries the record through. And while I'm not saying that the second half sucks, it certainly loses its steam by the time Love Is Only a Feeling rings out. Giving Up is certainly a decent take on an AC/DC tune, but Stuck in a Rut really goes off the rails with various screams during the verses. Friday Night is a pretty tune that seems to take aim at high-class school life, talking about various classes like gymnastics on Tuesday or archery on Thursday before dancing on Friday nights. And that's before the ironically titled track Love on the Rocks with No Ice. This tune is a weighty, dirty blues ditty that hits hard in the riff department, but with a 6-minute runtime, it's perhaps a bit too long. The closing track, Holding My Own, to me was always a sign that it was time to find a new CD and put it in my Discman, and so I found it a drab piece that is fitting for the closing track. Although I sound like I'm shitting on these few tracks, I do find them endearing, and most of them are still okay, but I do have to air my grievances that I feel. The Darkness achieved overnight success with their debut album, as it went 4 times platinum in the UK, and they would begin a world tour. Eventually, they would pick up the rock and roll tradition with drug and alcohol problems. It was touted that Justin spent nearly £150,000 on cocaine for Christmas after their success, to enjoy a truly white Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Take that, Stevie Nicks. 2 years later, Frankie would be dropped from the band, replaced by Richie on bass, and the band would release their follow-up album, One Way Ticket to Hell and Back, and it would receive a mixed response with lackluster sales figures. Many enjoyed the album, and others thought it was bad. I wonder if Hector from Chill Dude on the Couch would be interested in doing an episode on that album. Is it that bad? Well, let's ask the question to him. The Darkness would go on hiatus the following year, with various band members forming other bands like British Whale or Stone Gods, before reforming eventually in 2011, where they currently have released a further 5 albums, and Justin Hawkins has pursued the noble path of podcasting. Hey Justin, if you're listening, drop a comment. Also, would you be keen to do a collaboration? You know, if you're free or something, no big deal. Now, I think it's a perfect time to announce the final reason why I think this band really took off, in my opinion, and it can be boiled down to one word: nostalgia. The band's sound had tapped into that 80s sound of glam metal that many musicians prior had carved their fame out of. But like I've said earlier, that horse had bolted long ago. Perhaps to fully understand why the scene saw its resurgence with this album, we can look to today in music. In particular, the resurgence of the nu metal genre. For reasons unknown, this genre that we thought had long died out is starting to make a comeback. Spirit Box is a perfect example. They're taking the world by storm at the moment, and their influences were bands like Mudvayne and some of the others in that genre. It is also perhaps because of an army of my peers. Do you want to hear that sound and music once again? And are you looking for something that's new? In a similar vein, fans of the 80s glam metal scene were looking for a new thing, and when the old guard couldn't deliver, the Darkness was there for them. Nostalgia was in the air, and everybody was loving it. I guess this is the best example I can point to as to my thoughts why the Darkness made such an impact when they did. After all, nostalgia is a powerful tool when it can be harnessed. So if you ask me why Permission to Land became as big as it did, it's because of the multitude of these reasons. A charismatic and endearing frontman, a very talented group of musicians, insanely catchy songs, a change in the music scene, right place, right time, and nostalgia. Overall, I will be scoring this album at 12 million chilies on the spicy scale, with my favourite tracks being Black Shuck, Growing On Me, I Believe in a Thing Called Love, and Love Is Only a Feeling. There is no one reason why an album takes off as it does. There are always multiple reasons. I can't say for certain if these are the facts, but to me, they seem like the main contributions to its success. What I can say for certain is that I thoroughly enjoyed this album, and I do so every time I play it. People, comment below and tell me what your thoughts are, if there's anything that I missed during this review. And tell me also, what is your favourite track from this record? I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Retro Reviews. Make sure to do the socials and like this video, share the shit out of it, and I don't know, write it on a public toilet. If you can subscribe, that's a bonus, but if not, I'll see you on the next episode. As always, people, stay spicy. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Live Listen Erased. And if you have enjoyed this episode, make sure you share it with all your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to our Chili Con Carnage crew so you can get notified for all the future videos that we put out, as we put out videos every Friday. Also, we are on Discord, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter over at Live Listen Erased, so make sure to tune in over there. And don't forget to like this video so that our manager can stay very happy.